This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel, and you're listening to the hashtag STRask podcast. And we are ready to answer your questions from Twitter. Oh, yeah, we had that discussion last time. Sorry. We're here to respond to your questions, and you can decide if we've answered them for you. All right. So here is a question from Timothy Bayer. I've heard it said that the creation account is a polemic against the false gods of the surrounding nations at that time. What's your take on the matter?
Well, to me, that is obviously the case. Whether it is merely a polemic in a general form or whether it is meant to be a characterization of the events themselves on the creation day, however you construe it, is another question. That way of looking at the account is called a concordist account. So a concordist understanding of Genesis is that it goes beyond being a contrast to the ancient Near Eastern cosmologies that the Jews were for 400 years, as a nation for 400 years, had been tutored either indirectly or directly under while they're in Egypt, but it is actual and it is some kind of accounting of what took place. Now, it's an organized accounting of what took place. So a young earth creationist would be a concordist. Okay. So the Answers in Genesis crowd would be concordist in that sense, but a Hugh Ross would also be a concordist. He believes in an ancient universe, in an ancient earth, the standard kind of scientific assessments of the timing. But when he reads Genesis and he says he's read this even before he was a Christian, the first time he read it, it seemed, as a scientist himself, it seemed to be a kind of a concordist characterization, but not in a short period of time, over a longer period of time. So there are concordist views, either young earth or old earth, or there are non-concordist views. And some of those views would take the Genesis account, at least the first chapter and the first four verses of chapter 2, as a polemic, setting the record straight that what we're dealing with the God of the Hebrews, is something entirely and completely different from the other pantheons of ancient Near Eastern mythologies or religions. Notice, by the way, this is something that, because I was always kind of raised in circles that were concordist, either young earth early on for me and then old earth later. However, I had not thought about this other alternative. There's actually a kind of poetic structure to the account. You have you have disorder, and then you have order, okay, and then you have three spaces, and then three spaces are filled, okay, and then you have the crown of creation. That human beings are the center. They're the last because they're the center, their most important part. And then chapter 2 and 3 is more of a zoom-in camera on that particular part of creation. Some think it's a separate creation account, but I don't think it is. It's just kind of a isolated camera zooming in like you have in football. You have the big play, and then you zoom in on one character for the replay, and you get the details of that very important part of the play that made the difference in the game, however. And I think that something like that is going on. Notice also that not only this kind of the poetic structure, but you also have the sun and the moon don't have names. They have functions. They're not persons. They're things that are at the behest of the one true God who made them. Now, there's a book that I did an interview on a number of years ago that offers this characterization, I think, in a very rich way for people's consideration. It's in the beginning, we were confused.
We misunderstood.
Yeah, we were confused. Yeah, in the beginning, we misunderstood. And their point is you have to, and this is a great hermeneutical or Bible interpretation principle, that when you approach any passage, you have to approach it by looking at the intent of the author in light of the audience to whom he's writing. So Moses, who wrote the Pentateuch, and they're the first few chapters of Genesis, of course, then is writing to the Jews in his company, a nation of people who for almost half a millennium have been without any godly instruction, not only of their own heritage, like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc., but about the nature of the universe from the perspective of the one true God. And so Moses is informing that group by contrast to the worldly cosmologies about what actually is the state of affairs. And so this does raise the question, is he giving a concordance account or not? And they say, well, they don't think it is a concordance account. It's doing something else with it, and it's not meant to accomplish that goal. Say, here's what happened in the order that they took place. And it also discusses, and I think in the book, 7 Days That Divide the World by John Lennox, he also talks about you can describe a building, my house, for example, from an architectural design perspective where you have these different spaces that need to be filled, and or from a contractor's perspective. Contractor builds from the ground up, but an architect doesn't build from the ground up necessarily. He thinks of the spaces that need to be filled to accommodate certain activities, and then constructs a whole house around that. So the question is, what's going on in Genesis 1? Is it from a contractor's perspective from the ground up? That's concordist. Is it talking about, in a more general sense, like an architect talking about the spaces that need to be filled? That's living area, sleeping area, bathing, cleaning area, whatever, eating area. Then that would be a different way of understanding those books, mm-hmm. those chapters, rather.
And obviously, as you said, you know, it doesn't have to be like just a polemic. I mean, the truth is a polemic against the other
yes,
gods,
right.
No matter what it is. And I think I mentioned this book a few episodes ago, but there's a book called The Bible Among the Myths, and it does such a good job of explaining how revolutionary Genesis is, and the whole understanding of God as being outside of creation, of being the one who created everything out of nothing, as opposed to having the world always have existed and everyone being connected to everyone so that you could manipulate these mm-hmm. gods and get them to do what you wanted. The whole idea of manipulation and the way they did that makes no sense in light of Genesis.
Yeah, that's right.
It's completely radical change.
And all of these gods, pardon me, were limited gods. They were all finite. And a lot of times they, and even in modern religions like Hinduism, for example, these divine beings are very immoral in the way, and sensual and sexual and rabidly so in some cases. And so there are such a distinction between those deities and others. And incidentally, an atheist who stepped back and take in the whole picture, they deliver judgments against religion in general based on this broader pattern, when it turns out that biblical Christianity, biblical religion, is in a class all by itself. And so sometimes the atheists will say, well, look at you. You are an atheist regarding all these other gods. Why wouldn't you be an atheist? You just believe in one more God than we do. You don't believe in all these others. You reject them like we do. And so they make it sound like you're just one step away from us. So how can you justify when you reject all these others, you don't reject this one? And they're trying to take the intellectual higher ground here. And my answer to that is yes, that We do accept one less God than you. That's what makes us theists and you atheists. That is the nature of the distinction. And secondly, the reason we don't believe in all the other is because there's no reason to believe in all these others. But the God of the Bible is unique, as you're pointing out, mm-hmm. compared to this pantheon of options. And there is good reason to believe someone like the biblical God exists.
All right, here's a question from Dandy Prime. Would God allow someone who wants Jesus to deceive themselves into thinking they are regenerate when they're actually not?
Well, I've never been asked that question before, and does God allow deception? Of course he does. He allows people to deceive themselves, and he allows the devil to deceive people. That's straight up scriptural. The deceiver, you know, he's not just the tempter, he's the deceiver. He deceives by what? Lies. He lies from his nature, Jesus said in John 8. So definitely God allows deception, and that's maybe troubling for some people, and it's troubled me at times too, especially that the devil is allowed to deceive. So I haven't worked all that out, but biblically, certainly people are allowed to deceive. Are there people who believe in Jesus and who are deceived and don't really believe? Absolutely. Jehovah's Witnesses believe in Jesus. Your Mormon friends believe in Jesus. Muslims believe in Jesus. The New Agers believe in Jesus. All kinds of people believe in Jesus after a fashion. The question is whether they believe in the true Jesus. Now, I think there can be various understandings within the pale of orthodoxy, or let me put it this way, within the pale of doctrinal safety, where people can have little different understandings. So you have Christology from above and Christology from below. You have the Western Church, you have the Eastern Church, and so they look at things a little bit differently, but they're all in the Chalcedonian box, so to speak. It's a theological formula. So they're within the pale, even though there's variations. But once you get out of the Chalcedonian box, Jesus is fully God and fully man, one person, two natures. Well, then you've got Jesus all over the place, but he's not the true Jesus. The Jesus of the Mormons is not the true Jesus. They can call him whatever they want. It doesn't matter that they call him Jesus. What matters is the description of who he is. Their Jesus is not the infinite God who became a man in the person of the Word, the person of the Word becoming human being. That's not the LDS belief. They believe that Jesus was completely and wholly a created individual, just like we are. There's no difference. You can correct me if I'm wrong on this because you know more about this, Amy, but there's no difference between the ontological, metaphysical difference between Jesus and any one of the people listening. There is a qualitative difference because Jesus just got better over time than they did and achieved a kind of a godhood. But he's the same kind of individual. Well, classical Christianity doesn't hold that. Classical Christianity holds that Jesus is the God-man, and the God part being the infinite God who made everything that has ever been made. That's John chapter 1 stuff. So, you know, lots of people believe in Jesus, and they are deceived either by themselves or by the devil, angel of light, into believing in a false understanding of Jesus, and that error makes a difference because they're outside of the range of orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Yeah. So I in looking at this question, he says, would he allow someone who wants Jesus to deceive themselves into thinking? I think nobody wants the true Jesus unless they've been moved by God to want the true Jesus.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
So if you want the true Jesus, then you're not deceived by that.
That's right. That's because God is already working. And by the way, I think both Arminians and Calvinists agree on this, that God has got to work God has got to necessarily work in any individual who becomes a genuine believer. How far that work goes is a matter of difference of opinion, but God has got to work. And so you're right so far.
So now I'm going to make it worse for you because you said you have trouble dealing with the fact that God allows deception by our deception and also by the devil's. But 2 Thessalonians 2:11 also says that God does send deluding influences. It says he's talking about those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false mm-hmm. in order that they all may be judged who did not believe the truth but mm-hmm. took pleasure in wickedness. So they rejected the truth, and so God said, okay, go that direction because I'm going to judge you. It's the same right. thing as him hardening Pharaoh's heart so that, you know, he will judge him.
Well, Pharaoh hardens his heart, own heart first, and then God comes in after that, kind of complete the round of 10 plagues.
Right. So he's determined to judge these people who have rejected the truth, and so he sends a deluding influence so they remain in their falsehoods. So if you are desiring to know the truth about Jesus and you are seeking knowledge of Jesus from the place where God has revealed Jesus in the Bible, then just keep seeking that. Keep seeking the truth about mm-hmm. him. If you find yourself rejecting what the Bible says and thinking, but I think Jesus is this way, now you're in dangerous territory, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back and look at a few more details in 2 Thess, just to mm-hmm. expand on your point. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where she's making reference to God giving a deluding, sending upon them a deluding influence. Because in verse 9, it talks about Satan and those who come is in accord with the activity of Satan with all power and signs and false wonders. So there's a warning that there are miracles that are satanic, and the miracles that are satanic are deceptive influences. And then it says, and with all the deception, verse 10, of wickedness for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved, and for this reason God will send upon them a deluding influence. Now, there's two steps here, and I'll give you the second step in a moment, but the first step is they did not love the truth, and so they were open to the deceptions of the devil and the other deceptions that it says God then sends. But it isn't like there's these poor innocent people that God is going out of his way to trick and deceive. These are people who do not love the truth. They love something else. And that's the second step. Verse 12, in order that they will all be judged who did not believe the truth. Why didn't they believe the truth? Because they didn't love the truth, verse 10. But what did they love instead? They took pleasure in wickedness. And what this reminds me of, so you have people who don't love the truth, but love wickedness, essentially, taking pleasure in wickedness. These are people open to the deception of Satan and any other deluding influences that God would send. And I think this reminds me of John chapter 3, where it says that those who are judged loved darkness rather than the light. That's John 3:19, mm-hmm. I believe. And so, John 3:19.
Yeah, the delusion so is the judgment.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, that's right. So, well, delusion is part of the judgment, but it's also on the path to further
right,
judgment.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So, this is God's response to their lack of love of truth and love for wickedness. God just says, okay, well, I'm just going to... It's almost like in Romans 1, says God gave them over to these kinds of things. So it isn't that their guilty condition is a result of God just going out of his way to trick them. And I think that's the heart of the question. Mm-hmm. When you look more expansively at the passage and then consider some other texts, you see that there's actually quite a bit more going on here.
Right. Nothing in this passage is describing someone, quote, who wants Jesus. Who
really wants, yeah.
So it's not like there's anyone out there who is desperately wanting Jesus, but then God's saying, ha-ha, I'm going to keep you away from him. That's not a category in the Bible anywhere.
Incidentally, to me, as evidence, for example, let's just take with LDS, Mormons, as evidence that they don't love the truth, is they have a policy in their church that their people are not allowed to engage alternate ideas. They isolate them from alternate ideas. They don't want them reading books by so-called Mormon bashers. I have no problem with any Christian reading Richard Dawkins or Chris Hitchens or anybody else. You know, we're not trying to isolate people from those ideas. I mean, generally speaking, that's not Christianity. We're to go out there and embrace those ideas, get an understanding of what they are, and then tear them down. Okay? But Mormons, they want to close the doors, don't let any other influence in. Don't listen to those people. Don't question your own views. And if you do question, you leave. You go to the deepest pit of hell. That's Mormonism. You know, it's the most severe judgment is reserved for ex-Mormons. So these are all techniques that are manipulative to keep them from even considering anything else. And to me, that is an evidence that they don't love the truth. They are deeply committed to their system and their things, and you know, don't confuse me with the facts.
And it's easy for that
would you say, with your knowledge of Mormonism, that's a fair?
Yeah, and I'm about to tell a story, too, okay. that will illustrate this, because it's easy, and of course, I'm sure there are Christians like this, too, so this just isn't just a judgment on Mormons, but they have such close communities and such built-up communities that leaving that situation, you have to give up a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about what the disciples had to give up, you know, to follow Jesus. Mormons have a lot. They have their whole support structure that they would have to give up in order to leave Mormonism.
And some of the times that's financial, the way the businesses work together and stuff like that.
Oh, sure, yeah. But especially family, especially, you know, friends, family, things like that. So I once asked a missionary I was speaking to, I said, well, what if you saw that the truth was in one direction and the church was in the other direction?
Mormon church.
Yeah, the Mormon church. Which direction would you go? And he thought about it for a minute, and then he said, I'd go with the church.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually that committed to staying with the church, even if it wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to be a malicious, angry person to not have a love of the truth. You just have to love things more than truth and love things more than God and desire things more than God that will take you in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like we all have to deal with this. We all have to be careful about this and desire truth.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be saying that there is no Mormon that would characterize themselves as a non-lover of truth. I'm not believing this because it's false, you know, but I'm looking at the broader picture, and when you have a whole society, a cultural thing that has this approach to alternate views, it looks highly suspicious to me. And we're convinced that we have the truth, but we are not trying to keep alternates from other people. We're trying to address those.
Mm. Thank you, Greg. We're a little bit over time, so thank you, everyone, for sticking with us. And we look forward to hearing you on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.